Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Leah Cooper from Minnesota. Welcome to the show, fellow adoptee Leah. Looking forward to this.
Thanks, Simon. It's awesome
Yeah.
to be here.
And Leah is just 1 year younger than me. You were born in 68, if I remember rightly. Was it?
Correct,
Yeah.
May 1968.
Yeah, so I'm 60. I was born in 67. I almost said I'm 67, but no, I'm only 56. Don't wish away those years, Simon. When I was listening to you on Hayley's excellent podcast, Adoptees On, you talked about the story that you tell yourselves tell yourself about yourself, and you talked about feeling like an outsider. And also that you feel much less like an outsider now. So what do you think have been the key things that have led to that change about feeling more at home and less as an outsider?
Well, it's not a straight line, of course, right? Or an on-off switch. But I mean, as I talked about a little bit on the podcast with Hayley, a big click, maybe that makes it sound too sudden, a slow, painful cracking open took place when my theater company and I decided to make a play about adoption by talking to hundreds of people in the adoption community, right? And the more I heard not only adoptees talk, but also birth parents and adoptive parents, the more I started feeling feelings that I didn't understand and I couldn't name at first, right? I think this is not so different from most people coming out of the fog, right? Is, oh, I'm feeling things and they hurt and they scare me and they make me angry and want to tear the world apart and I don't know why, right? So that started happening. And I didn't, even though I was surrounded by adoptees, at first I really didn't understand what was happening to me. And I have to add that there was a layer that my marriage was ending at the same time. So it was difficult to separate these things. Am I cracking open because my marriage is ending, or is my marriage ending because I'm cracking open? And where does being an adoptee fit into all this, right? So that was a painful year. But at a certain point, after my marriage ended, after the play was done, when I sat alone in my house for hours and hours and hours, I just let myself cry. I just cried and cried and cried and cried and cried and cried, many hours every single day. And it didn't even feel like emotion. It felt like a physical purge, you know, like a seizure or the hiccups, except it involved sobbing, right? And sometimes I would be like, my God, Leah, you have to get out of the chair. You have to get out of the house. And I'd go for a walk, you know, and we have beautiful lakes here in Minnesota. And I would just put on big sunglasses and walk around the lake while tears streamed down my face. And I would just hope nobody noticed this strange woman walking in circles with tears streaming down her face, because I didn't want anybody to ask me what was wrong, because I did not know the answer. But eventually, little by little, I was like, oh, grief. This is grief. I'm grieving. I'm grieving that I didn't get all these things. And I can't go back and get them now, right? And so I will say, you know, and I don't think what I'm describing is so different from a lot of people's experience, regardless of what age it happens and what triggers it. But there was finally a settling down. And I remember a moment when I said, I thought to myself, careful, Leah, you could get really comfortable with grief as your best friend. You know, like once I started embracing it and started saying, what if I don't flee this? What if I just let it happen? It felt good. It felt like a warm bath, you know? And I sat in it for a long time, but then two key things happened. I found out a friend died of cancer, and I didn't even know she had cancer. And she was somebody who I know was staying inside and grieving. And I was like, you can really surround yourself so much with grief that you've separated from the world, right? Careful. And then I had another friend who I had observed had sort of maybe just decided to stay high all the time instead of grieving. And, you know, a very nice person, a good friend. Staying high hadn't made him any less of a friend, but it did sort of mean that he stopped being fully in the world. And I started realizing he was just boring as hell, you know, and I was like, ooh, careful. And so it was like two different situations where a little voice inside my head said, careful, you know, like don't fall in love with your grief and make it your sole companion. And so I did sort of crawl my way back out into the world. And so this gets all the way back to your question of being an outsider. So I crawled back out with this idea in my head that I had lost something. There was no going back and getting, and I simply had to accept that about myself. So that made me more comfortable with my who I really was, not the cheerful, you know, orphan Annie who dances and smiles for her dinner, but the you know, sad person who also can be funny and dance, right? I tried to find that yes and reality of myself. I am somebody who is sad and I am somebody who can be in the world. I don't have to hide, but I still felt like an outsider because I'm like, I'm walking around being this person who lost something they can never get back. And while other people have that experience too, the adoptee version of it is pretty unique, right? You know? And then I started putting myself in community with other adoptees. And I was a little surprised to figure and notice that I still kind of felt like an outsider, even among adoptees, you know, for a variety of reasons. One, I'll just say it. You adoptees, you run right to talking about reunion. Let's talk about reunion. Are you reunited? Do you know your birth parents? Do you know where you came from? Where are you in that process? And I'm always like, I'm not doing that process. I'm not interested in that process. And I could talk at length about why I'm not, but I'm just not. I'm not interested in reunion. And so then I'm right away, I'm like, oh, I'm not in this conversation. I'm here. I am an outsider here. So that's something that sort of made me go, wow, where am I an insider? My gosh, you know. But there's an interesting thing I have observed, which is that in my work at my theater company, we often make plays, not just with adoptees, but other communities. And they're often communities who've been silenced. They're often communities with trauma. And what I notice is I feel less like an outsider surrounded by people with trauma that they have worked through, and they are now trying to use the strength of the wounded healer, right? And I go, oh, that's me, wounded healer, right? And so I will say part of my journey to feeling less like an outsider is saying, I don't think adoptees are a homogenous block. I don't think we all have the same journey out, and I don't think we have the same journey to strength. I think we share a lot, right? But they're not the only people I find kinship with. You know, and it's a maybe important context to add that I grew up in a family, my adoptive family had a lot of mental illness, and there was a lot of neglect and a lot of trauma. And so sometimes I identify more with that community, you know, people who've experienced that. But finally, okay, now I'm going to get to the part where I'm going to say, here's how I'm starting to feel less like an outsider. Sorry, I tell stories in circles. I met my current partner, who's also an adoptee. Here, I just said that I don't necessarily find community in adoptees, but my partner is an adoptee. And we discovered this by accident on our very first date. And I think we both just stopped in shock and stared at each other, because I think we both immediately knew that was something special. Like, it's not what you, we didn't think to put it in our dating profile, right? Like, it's not something I thought to look for. But when we looked each other in the eye, I went, you're adopted? I'm adopted. Mm. What? Oh, it's like we could feel that there was something that we shared that didn't even need words, you know, and that has played out in our relationship, right? Like, I do think that it can be easier to have a domestic relationship with somebody you share culture with. But as an adoptee, I've never been able to name my culture, right? Is it a culture of outsiderness? Is it a culture of I grew up with mentally ill people? Neither of those feel quite right. But he and I share a culture of all the little quirks of being an adoptee, right? All the ways that we're like, I don't want to be in your way. Oh, don't ever reject me. Is that rejection? Ah, you know, like we can see in the other one's eyes the moment we're having an adoptee moment, and we can go, oh, here, let me just hug you. It's okay. You know, like, and that vocabulary of all of our weird little quirks of abandonment issues and control issues and compulsions around feeling safe, like, that's our shared culture. So in this relationship, for the first time, when I am at home, I don't have to be alone to feel in community. Oh my God, I just admitted something. I think I only ever used to feel in community when I was alone or in nature, right? Like, I felt more in community with animals and trees and the ocean than I did with other humans until I met my partner. And there I feel in community with him. So that's a big one. The other place I am feeling more and more, less and less like an outsider, is I have started writing my own stories. I signed up for this writing cohort with Anne Heffron, who you know, is a memoirist and a writing teacher. And she just really encouraged all of us to start just telling our story from our point of view, she would give us these weird exercises like write with your angry voice in all caps and then read it aloud shouting, you know. And it was just like this exercise in not being afraid that our view of the story is entitled to be told from our point of view. And it's been this real slow process for me in which I didn't think I had any stories to tell. And now I have like 16 journals full of words. So the more I let myself spend time with my own story, the more I go, you know what? My story is not so weird. I'm not an alien. I'm a human like other humans who had some weird stuff happen.
I can see Leah. You can't listen. And I can guarantee you that she is definitely not an alien. But she is. I didn't time that, Leah. But I asked one question, right? And off you went. I'm going to rein. Can I rein you back in?
Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. That's me. I said I have no stories to tell. And then I talked for like 20 minutes straight.
Okay. The thing I'm learning at the moment, at a deeper level, when you said something about it, it really landed for me, is you became less afraid of your emotions. So the genie was out of the bottle, or the cork was out of the bottle, whatever, and you cried your way through it. And so instead of like, it's supposed to be us boys that don't cry, isn't it? According to gender stereotyping, and also The Cure, if you were the same kind of the same age, you know, I had that on my college bedroom. I had that that poster. So I saw a guy putting the billboard posters up, you know, the big ones, you know, as big as, you're huge, you know, like 8 foot by 4 foot, something like that. And it's a backlit shot of Robert Smith, presumably from The Cure, and it's black and white, and it says "Boys Don't Cry," right? So I had that up. I had that up on my college, and it was a stunning image. And the connection. There is a connection here. I don't know if you've heard of a book by Albert Camus called L'Étranger. Have you heard of that book?
Yes. Stranger. So, yes.
The Stranger. Yes. Is it Stranger? Or is it The Outsider? I'm not sure which.
Oh, I think it can be. I've seen it translated both ways. I read that as a teenager, and I think what The Catcher in the Rye was for a lot of other people, that book was for me. I was like, yes, this explains the world to me completely. Yes.
It freaked me out, existentialism. Yeah. Robert Smith from The Cure is that's why there's a song called Killing an Arab, which is, yeah. it is the story behind Albert Camus' L'Étranger. We don't really normally do literary references, but I'm making it a bit more pop culture, isn't it? Because I'm talking about The Cure. So, and I'm linking it to The Outsider. And yeah, Boys Don't Cry. Adoptees don't cry, and you remember again flipping back to what you said on to Haley, you were the good one, you know, you were the good adoptee that sings and dances, as you say, and you didn't let it go, and then suddenly, kaboom, you're letting it go, and those tears washed away. This is my theory. This is me putting my experience onto you as a suggestion. Okay. So my tears lasted a lot shorter than yours did, but they did the same job, and they washed some of my trauma away. That's what I think happened to me. And you, again, referring to Haley, the interview Haley, we better put a link in the show notes, hadn't it, to that. I'll do that. So if you want to know more about her story, Leah's story, check out that. Because Thriving Adoptees is about insights. lessons to me. You felt, you talked about a volcano, a volcanic eruption of grief, or a volcano of grief, right? And you felt that coming. You felt the earth rumbling for a while before the volcano erupted, right? I had a volcano of grief. Mine came out as anger, and mine came completely out of the blue. Completely out of the blue, and it was a lot shorter than yours. So the run-up to it was shorter, and the eruption was shorter. And you talked about to Haley that it's still simmering. Your volcano is still simmering. And that was January last year, I think you did. It was released, so we don't know when it was recorded. But do you still feel that it's simmering, your volcano?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And again, it might be because I think I'm unpacking layers of loss, many different kinds of loss.
Yeah. What's underneath the layers?
Well, you know, there's the first one, the relinquishment, right? In my mind, I have this image.
What's under the layers? What is it that's under the layers? I'm not sure if I know the answer myself, but I think it's.
Oh, you mean like if we really could get to the bottom of all of the layers, what would be sitting there beneath?
Yeah.
Oh gosh, that is a really good question. Do we get to know that? I don't know. Maybe in the moment of death or something, we're gifted the glimpse of that. But I think
it's consciousness. It's consciousness.
Yeah, it's the sense of self, right? I mean, to get all existential.
No, it's not the sense of self.
It's the actual self.
It's the actual self. And it's not a thing, so we can't see it.
Yeah.
Only awareness knows awareness, right? Only awareness.
Well, and I do think, you know, common to all humans, but amplified for adoptees and people with childhood trauma, is this idea that we have an essential self and that everything that has happened to us, you can either believe that everything that happens to the essential self modifies us or takes something away from us or gives us something, right? But we all have this idea that there's this essential self we show up with, right?
Or does nothing to us.
Or does nothing to us, that it's all an illusion. Yeah, yeah.
Well, not that it's it's like, so I'm working on metaphors on this is a metaphor on this I came up with this morning, right? So there's a difference. A snow globe has two things, right? It's really cold and icy in Minnesota at the moment. So it's a relevant metaphor given the weather that you're having.
Thanks.
So the snow globe has two things. It's got water and it's got snow, right? So and we shake it up and it's all mixed up, right? And then we let it settle and it divides into two things, the water and the snow. I've never shared this metaphor with anybody else till you. So here's the thing. The trauma is the snow and we are the water.
Mm.
And we get the two things mixed up. We, as in the human race, as in adoptees, as in people who have trauma, we get the two things mixed up. We can't see where we end, we begin and the trauma ends. We can't decouple from it. So what you said about, you were at one point, you were tempted to sit in the grief, right? So, but some the little voice told you not to do that.
Mm.
The little voice told you not to do that. And I've had a few little voices in my time, and I'm with my wife because of a little voice, right? Mm. My little voice, the little voice is our intuition. And that's what moves us forward. I'm used to a brass band going off in my head, a loud voice that says that I'm not good enough. So at the moment, until fairly recently, it's been saying you're not having enough impact. That's what it's been saying to me.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And our fellow, have you come across an Aussie adoptee called Vin? You come across him?
Vin. No.
Great guy. He's been through a hell of a lot. But he before Christmas, he helped me see that. He helped me see the lie in what my inner voice was telling me, basically criticizing me for not having enough impact. So no, normally the voice in my head is really loud and very negative. It says I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough for business. I'm not having a good enough impact. And then obviously they're adoptee stuff. So that's the one that gets all our attention, the loud voice. And then occasionally we get this little voice of intuition. So your little voice of intuition said to you, don't sit in this grief. Don't cuddle up too close to it. And don't let it become you. You snuggled up with it, but you didn't let it become you. Okay. So you saw in that moment, you saw yourself as the water and not the snow.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. I think, you know, part of what I think I also realized was, I think when the grief, once I could name it and realize it was a part of me, I started clinging to it.
It's not a part of you.
Well, I mean,
as the snow though, when it's all shaken up.
Right. Well, let me explain what I mean by it. I don't mean the trauma. I mean the emotion, right? Once I said, oh, I have grief. I feel grief. This is a feeling of mine. Going back to the homework I could never do, right? I couldn't name a need. I couldn't name an emotional need. Once I could say, oh, I need to grieve. I have grief that I need to express. I kind of clung to it for a little while because I felt as though I had not been allowed to do it. I had not been given space or safety or freedom to have that emotion, right? And so I clung to it as though someone might take it away from me, right? And I think then I realized though that I didn't need to cling to it. It was never going to, it was my access to it is always there. Nobody can take it away from me. And that's what sort of freed me to say, oh, I don't have to cuddle with it every single day. It doesn't have to be my best friend. I don't have to cling to it. I don't have to let it define me. It is one of a million emotions I can feel at any given time about my own life experience. And it isn't me. It is an expression of emotion, right? And so I don't know how to apply that to the snow globe metaphor.
Okay. No worries. That's okay. What does define you?
Oh my gosh, what does define? These are questions, Simon. My goodness. Let's see. What does define me?
I'm happy to slow you down and make you think a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I know. I appreciate that. I think, you know, when it's all right. No, when I look, if I try to name, you know, what is the essential me? I have always been a searcher. I have always been the most curious person I know. And I am curious beyond the easiest modalities or the first ones offered to me, right? So I will say that part of my journey of self-acceptance has involved a vivid, lucid dream life with animals that show up and talk to me and lead me in and out of places, submerged places into ancient memories, right? Part of what has saved me has been meditation and body work and somatics, you know, part of what has, and it saved me is the wrong word, part of what has given me passage on this journey of searching is my dream life. It is my body. It is my consciousness and its relationship to my body. It is what happens to me collectively when I am in community with other people also searching, and we let ourselves be vulnerable to that possibility that we will feel something we don't want to feel, right? And so I think if you say what defines me, it is the search. It is the idea that I don't need to believe that there is an end of the road or an answer to the question. The search itself is what I am here to do. And if I have an offering, speaking of this question of, am I making a big enough impact, right? Which is like, trust me, I struggle with that one also, right? What I am here to do for myself is keep searching. What I am here to offer is sharing the journey, right? Whether that means we walk alongside on the same path, or I just say, here's what I'm seeing over here. You know, what are you seeing over there? Right. I think that is how I recently learned to reground myself in not measuring my worth in other people's notions of impact and success and self-actualization. What I measure is, am I continuing to search? Am I continuing to share the search?
Yeah. So who would you be without the search then?
Well, I guess I would just be resting on the side of the road.
have you heard of, I'm going to rephrase this in non-religious language. The journey to consciousness and then the journey in consciousness. So seeing who we are, i.e. the water, not the snow of trauma. And I'm also going to extend my metaphor of snow. I'm going to say that the snow is also grief. It comes in this metaphor. It's the same thing. It's not essential to us. So we're stripping back all that is non-essential to us. And we're seeing who we are as which we can't see, because it's spirit, you know, it's not a thing. It's image, consciousness isn't a thing, so you can't see it. That's why I have to use metaphors. So it's a bit like the invisible man or the invisible woman or the invisible non-binary person, whatever you want to call it. We can't see who we truly are. The invisible man and the invisible person is made of space.
Mm.
It's closer to spirit, so we can't see it. That's why we can't find it. We're too close to it. We are like the fish that doesn't know it's a fish. You know, we're the journey to consciousness and then the journey in consciousness. So the journey to consciousness happens, the glimpse of it. The glimpse of it, and we keep on having those. We have those glimpses all the time. So you talked about in nature, being in nature. So what happens is in nature for me, what happens is the voice inside our head is silent, and we are rendered speechless and thoughtless by the view. By the beauty of the view, and we project our peace on the landscape, and we think, "Oh, I must go hiking." Or we are connecting with the whole universe. We're seeing our spaciousness. We're seeing the spaciousness that we are. Reflected in the world around us, we're seeing that we are the universe. You know, universe, one song, and then the phone rings, doesn't it? And we've got to go back down the mountain because our dog's ear or something, you know, like, oh, we've got a leak, you know, the frozen pipe's gone or something. And we lost, and we lose that connection. We lose that connection to that space. So, and also, you know, we're looking for enlightenment. We're searching, and the search keeps the brain going. And whilst the brain's going, it doesn't find peace. So there's two stages: the journey to seeing who we are, the journey to God, as some people say, and then the journey in God. The journey in God is the one that never ends. But we're expecting this seeing ourselves. You know, we go to India. People go to India to see themselves, to go to the East to find themselves, and they take their SH1T with them, don't they?
Oh yeah, you can't get far enough away from yourself to flee. Yes.
No, because it's the emotional baggage or the trauma that we're carrying, and we haven't decoupled from our trauma. So we take our trauma with us wherever we go, and sometimes it's the sometimes the backpack is lifted off us.
You know, what you just described about this idea, this thing you just said about, you know, we go to nature and then we sort of project our peace onto nature and we credit nature for what we maybe really just, you know, found in ourselves. This resonates against so many things for me. You know, on the simplest level, one, I want to say I was a lifetime smoker who also quit smoking after I came out of the fog. And you know, I read this book called The Easy Way to Quit Smoking, which is like the most innocuous title ever, but it really did help me quit smoking. And one of the things it said in the book was that you think you go outside to have a cigarette because the cigarette makes you feel calm, right? But it's really the going outside and the breathing deep that maybe is doing that, and simply making the choice to take a break from the world, right? And that was like this really grounding revelation for me that, like, you
It's
think you're smoking, but you're really being still and breathing, you know, and you associate this habit with it to give yourself permission to do it, you know. It also makes me think, so a revelation I've had recently,
we like revelations on this show.
oh my God. And I have a revelation every day. Like, I'm a revelation a day generator. So really, Simon, you could just call me every day and I'll toss a revelation at you. But no, this recent one is, you know, so during COVID, whether we've all spent a lot of time on Zoom, right? And I'm somebody who often gets hired to facilitate difficult conversations. It's just a knack I have and a skill I've cultivated, and now it's part of my career. And during COVID, of course, I got asked to facilitate Zoom-based conversations, and difficult ones at that. And so, even though I did not enjoy the experience of being on Zoom really probably any more than anybody else, I really tried to lean into how do we do this, you know? And what I found is we, just like in real life, we really try to fill the silence, you know, and we try to cover whatever discomfort is being generated either by the conversation or the format, right? And what I also found was that everybody was sort of physically exhausted and everybody was having trouble feeling their own senses, right? We were all these disembodied heads in our cocoons who were terrified of the world outside. And so I started, I had learned from somebody else, I forget who, I'm not going to successfully give credit here, but somebody had talked about the productivity of silence. That sometimes in a group, it's good to just take a breath and make space for silence and to not feel like we have to fill every space. Because what happens is the noisy people fill the space, and the people who are maybe more introverted or just need more time to formulate their thoughts, they never get a word in edgewise, right? Because us noisy people, I'm talking about myself, fill every space, right? And so just a simple little technique I would bring to these Zoom conversations is I would say, throughout the conversation today, at various moments, I'm going to invite us to pause and take a breath and observe the productivity of silence, which is really just a way of going, don't worry, we're still doing something useful, even if we stop talking for a minute, right? And it was good. It would just sort of reset the conversation. It would give people time to ground their nervous system. It would give space for the introverts to maybe speak up after the pause. But the other thing it did was, for me, I noticed it created the same thing that happens kind of when you go stand somewhere in silence in nature with other people. You feel a greater sense of connectedness to your own nervous system to their nervous systems and to the larger world, right? You kind of return to yourself, you know? And the idea that I could have that sensation and observe that sensation among others in something so unnatural as a Zoom video conference was kind of a revelation. It feels comparable to what you just said about maybe crediting the mountain for what was actually the stillness you made for yourself inside, you know? And so I think for me, when you go back to your question, what would I be if I stopped searching? It would be somebody in stillness, filling the stillness of everybody else, all the other living beings, and realizing we're connected, whether we're doing anything at all.
Well, the good news is that we are the stillness.
Right. So it's easy to return to if we just let ourselves.
So the trauma gets in the way of that. The thoughts get in the way of that. You know, the voice in the head gets in the way of that. So have you heard me talking about the big swimming pool in the big swimming pool in Leeds that I sometimes use?
No, tell me about the big swimming pool in Leeds.
It's just a metaphor, right? So at Christmas, my little swimming pool is 25 meters, whatever that is, 28 yards. So is shut for maintenance. And I go to a big swimming pool. It's 50 meters, whatever that is, 60 yards long. Okay. And what people call an Olympic pool, right? So it's an Olympic size pool, and it's got a massive plastic wall that rises up from the bottom of the floor of the pool to make it into two small pools. Okay, pretty cool. It's about 8 foot long. Is you know you can walk on this plastic, like reinforced, really heavy duty stuff, right? So. The tears that I shed reading a letter from my birth mother were like that wall collapsing instantaneously. Mm-hmm. So I merged, me and my birth mother merged into one. That's what I thought at the time. We became one. Visceral experience. But it wasn't just me connected with my birth mother. Because I've had the same experience watching The Killers in Sheffield. I've had the same at a concert. I've had the same experience listening to 40,000 rugby fans in Murrayfield singing the Scottish national anthem, and I'm not even Scottish, right? I have felt, I'm getting the feeling now, I'm tingling all over my body. I don't know if you're getting that.
I'm too, yes.
Yeah, okay. And here we are, 4,000 miles away. Did you watch Love Actually?
Yes, a long time ago. Yes.
Because the no-hoper, this British lad from London that's not having any love. And his life it's Wisconsin. He goes to Milwaukee, doesn't he? And these three girls jump on him basically in this bar. Anyway, that would have been a good story if you're from Wisconsin, but you're not, you're from Minnesota. So it's a visceral experience of being one, as I say this quote all the time, you know, one spiritual being having 7 billion, whatever it is, 8 billion experiences. We are all one. And my 40 seconds of anger towards my birth mother in whatever that was, 40-odd years at the time, 48 years at that time, that 40 seconds of anger was the plastic wall that collapsed and we became one. And we are that oneness, and that's what we find under all the layers, in my opinion, all the layers of feeling, all the layers of grief, all the layers of trauma, all the layers of anger, all the levels of insecurity, all the thoughts that we're not good enough, all the thoughts that I will be good enough when I reconnect. Yeah. What do you make of that?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I think the tingles that you describe, you know, that come from this experience. I think that these experiences, what they have in common, which you described, and I could toss out a comparable list, right? Is this sort of getting around those frontal lobes of ours, you know, that want to narrate the experience to the most primal understanding of ourselves as living beings, made up of the same matter as all the other living beings around us. And to bring it in, you know, a little less cosmic, to simply human beings as part of a collective system, not just socially, not just culturally, not just intellectually, but at the cellular level, what we feel, what we experience, who we are. I think when we scream together in a stadium, or we all hold very still to maybe all look at a star or to hear the tone of a bell, whatever. When we unite in our sensory experience, and if even more so, we open the channel of that sensory experience to our deepest emotional well, our deepest fears, our deepest hopes, our deepest dreams, all of that. I think we get we the gift we get is we get to transcend the story and be the essential self that you're describing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we're fundamentally unwoundable.
Fundamentally what? Say it again.
Unwoundable.
Unwoundable. Yes. Oh, I love it. Invincible. Well, unwoundable is better. Yes, it's true. I think this word resilience, you know, sometimes we feel really complimented by that word. Sometimes we feel really condescended by that word, but unwoundable is a better word, maybe. Is we it, the warrior who is unwoundable is the essential self, regardless of the trauma or the snow in the snow globe, as you describe it. Yeah. I
Beautiful.
agree. I think this is a thing we discover again and again and again, and then we forget, and then we discover, and that's the
That's
forever.
genius. That's genius. Because we sold a story of once and forever, once and done, and it's not. We touch it, we lose it. We touch it, we lose it. It's a bit like falling asleep and being awake.
Oh
Like,
my God, I think it's exactly like that. I think that's what's always missing in the mythic hero journey story structure. This idea that we go into the darkness, we come back, and now we're awake forever. No, I think we go to sleep and we wake up, and we go to sleep and we wake up. I think it is just like sleeping and dreaming and living.
and when we know we're going to wake up, we're less afraid of the dark.
Yes. Yes, I
And
agree.
we don't fight the dark. You let the dark in, and it didn't engulf you. We're terrified. I'm sorry, I'm talking about myself here. I'm terrified. We're terrified of being engulfed by our emotions, and that's why we keep them at bay. And when we let them in, and we find out that they can't actually hurt us.
It's not only that they can't hurt us, they are part of the full range of who we are, right? We are all of these experiences that have even come before us.
Okay, that's going to be the next conversation. We need to wrap this
Chapter
one up.
two.
Thank you very much. I will put a link, put a link to Wanderlust. This is your company in the show notes. Is there anything else you want me to link to?
I think that's it. You know, Wanderlust. I'll give you a link to the page that's all about our adoption project, because there's a lot there to dig into.
Thanks a lot, listeners, and thank you, Leah. I gotta
Thanks,
go.
Simon. What a
Keep
journey.
safe.
Thank you.
Thanks
I
a
have
lot.
revelations to take into my day.
Revelations. Revelation, one revelation a day keeps the doctor away, therapist away. Right. Ta-ra, bye.